Welcome to Food for Thought. My name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau from Compassionate Cooks. I founded Compassionate Cooks to empower people to make informed food choices and to debunk myths about vegetarianism and animal rights. You can learn more about who we are and what we do by visiting our website, CompassionateCooks.com. From there, you can check out our cookbook, The Joy of Vegan Baking, our cooking DVD, our articles and essays, or you can join the message board, which is a great way to connect with other podcast listeners. So thank you for being here. Hi, everybody. I hope you're all well. Before we get started, I have a very, very exciting announcement to make. Many of you have asked for this, and your wish has come true. We now have podcast sampler CDs. Thanks to Marty and Wendy Beckers, who sponsored this project, and Chris Marco, who designed the CDs, we now have a sampler CD. It's beautiful. It contains 5 podcast episodes, including a welcome introduction from me, and the 5 episodes are The Protein Myth and Vegetarianism, Where Do I Get My Calcium If I Don't Drink Cow's Milk, What's Wrong with Eating Eggs Since the Hens Aren't Killed, 10 Tips for Eating Veg in Social Situations, and How Humane Are Humane Meat, Dairy, and Eggs. And I think it's a good compilation. I think it's a compilation that encompasses the various topics we cover. I was limited to 70 minutes, so it's difficult to put a lot on there. And since I got pretty long-winded after the first several episodes, I really had to choose carefully to find a nice variety. Maybe someday we'll have more than one sampler CD, but we'll see. I'd love to do one on the stories, the literature, but they tend to be pretty long. So this is a great start. I'm incredibly excited about it. It could really mean a wider reach. It really depends on you helping distribute these CDs. If you're interested in distributing the CD, it's one CD and it's beautifully designed, and then it's in a little paper sleeve. So it's available in packs or increments of 10 for $10 plus shipping. So if you want large quantities, we're also sending out packets of 100 for $65 plus shipping. And the more sampler CDs that get into your hands, the more you can help spread the word. It really could help reduce that barrier that some people have to listening to the podcast because they don't know what a podcast is or how to listen to one. So if you're interested, they're ready for you. You can visit CompassionateCooks.com to purchase the CDs. You'll see a link off the homepage, and you'll see a page off of the menu item called Writings Podcast. I think it says Podcast Sampler CD. And thank you to each and every person who requested this CD. And again, thank you to Marty and Wendy Beckers and to Chris Marco. Speaking of generous people, we have 2 sponsors for today's episode. The first is Michelle Williams, who wrote the following email. Hi, Colleen. It was my birthday a couple days ago, and I wanted to send you a contribution for your podcast as a gift to both you and myself. I've been a vegetarian for 20 years, but 3 months ago, I became vegan just by listening to what you had to say. I get so much from these frequent visits I make to your website and from your podcast that I want to make sure you keep them coming. I work as a veterinary technician, so I'm surrounded by people who are very passionate about animals, but I can't seem to penetrate the wall that encircles people's beliefs about food animals. I wish they could really see and understand the lives and deaths these beautiful creatures endure, all because we like the taste of their flesh. It's hard not to be discouraged, but I really do feel strengthened by your words, as do so many others. Please keep it up. Thank you, Michelle. Well, maybe they'd be interested in listening to the CD if you gave it to them. You know, you could always leave the CDs around, just kind of leave them around on a counter somewhere and maybe someone would pick them up. But that's an example of a way to get someone to listen. They can do it on their own time. They don't feel pressured. And again, there's not this technical barrier that keeps them from listening. So thank you. The second sponsor is Taylor Wagner. She wrote to me via email a while ago, and she said, I just made my first contribution to your wonderful podcast. I know that this amount is nowhere near the value I have received in information. I always look forward to the new podcast, and I listen to past podcasts every night before I go to sleep. I'm a newbie vegan. I cannot believe it has taken me this long to make the connection. I'm happy to report that my mother is now vegetarian and is slowly making the transition to veganism. My fiancé is still a meat eater, but I am a constant reminder, pleasant, but constant. As you have said in a previous podcast, I am the vegan in the room. I'm happy to say, though, that he eats the meals that I prepare and has admitted that he feels healthier for doing so. So thank you, Taylor. Thank you, Michelle. Both of you keep up the great work. Being the vegan in the room, it's a very powerful position to have. And I think once people really understand the power of that, you don't have to do very much more than just be that, than just be that truth. It's quite remarkable. So I hope you're both still enjoying the podcast, and I thank you very much for your support. If you would like to become a sponsor, please visit CompassionateCooks.com, where you can contribute online. Using your credit card, you can certainly contribute offline with a check, or you can call in your credit card. You can call in over the phone. All the contact information you need is on the website, CompassionateCooks.com, and I appreciate whatever you can do. If you think this podcast is worth continuing and you can scrape together an extra $5 a month or $10 a month or $15 a month digging for change in your car, foregoing a soy latte for one day, then I urge you to consider sponsoring. If you look forward to the podcast, if you've ever quoted the podcast, if you've listened more than once to any of the episodes, or if you've recommended this podcast, then it seems to me that you would want to help keep it going. So thank you for considering sponsoring. I'm very grateful, and I could not do this without you. Now, let's get on with the episode. I've been wanting to do this episode for a while, so here it is. I hope it's not too late for those of you who are planting your summer gardens. You can certainly start planting your autumn gardens now. I hate dating the podcast. This is June that I'm recording this, but it doesn't matter. This episode is relevant no matter what month you're listening to it. And I do try to be sensitive to people all around the world. I'm aware that not everyone has the weather that the San Francisco Bay Area is blessed to have. We have a garden year-round, but we do rotate it according to the season, so I do adhere to that concept. Many people don't think we have seasons here, but that's not true. We have four seasons. They're just not as extreme. I grew up on the East Coast. I know what extreme seasons are. We get several months of rain in the winter here in the San Francisco Bay Area, which I love, and it definitely gets cold. It just doesn't freeze. So, well, if you're in San Francisco, it's freezing. But I say that because I'm in Oakland, and I'm not just saying this because I live here, but Oakland has the perfect weather in the Bay Area, possibly in the country, but I'm biased. It's really perfect weather. We don't get the fog that San Francisco and Berkeley get. It's not as hot as towns east of here. It's perfect. It's like warm in the sun. You go in the shade. It's nice and cool. You certainly don't have the humidity that I grew up with back east. But I still haven't learned to bundle up when I go to San Francisco. I just wind up complaining the entire time because it's freezing. It's like freezing in San Francisco every time. I haven't learned. I don't know if I'll ever learn. So anyway, the point is, I say this aware that not everyone has the weather that we have here in Oakland. However, as we head into summer, most everyone can create a garden as long as they have sun. And even though our garden changes according to the season, I have to say that summer is my favorite, mainly because of the tomatoes. We get a huge amount of tomatoes here in our garden, and they tend to last well into the fall. So summer is my favorite season for harvesting. So let's begin. Let's start talking about vegan gardening. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that you need to have animal products to grow plants. The people who wax poetic about our history of eating animals are also the ones who will declare with absolute conviction that we need to keep exploiting animals because how else would we fertilize our crops? Well, I have an answer to that. Surprise, surprise. Remember the episode called The Nutrients We Need Are Plant-Based? Remember that? Or even other episodes where I talk about the fact that cow's milk has calcium because of the green leafy plants they eat, which contain the calcium, how the fish eat the phytoplankton to get their omega-3s, that it's the plants that contain the fatty acid that the fish then eat. Remember that concept? Well, the same goes for the nutrients in the soil, the nutrients that the plants need to grow. These nutrients fertilize the soil and promote plant growth. The three main plant nutrients are nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, NPK. And I'll come back to those initials in a second. But there are also secondary plant nutrients. There's calcium, sulfur, magnesium. There's also trace elements or micronutrients such as boron or chlorine, iron, zinc, and copper. And though you'll come across the secondary and trace elements in your gardening endeavors and your research, the three primary minerals you need to pay attention to and which you'll see on every box of fertilizer you see in the store are nitrogen, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. Those are the big three, and you'll see them expressed as NPK. N for nitrogen, P for phosphorus, and K for potassium, referring to the Latin name on the periodic table. Remember the periodic table of chemical elements? You remember that the symbol for potassium is K, referring to its Latin name, kalium. So just remember that the P in NPK refers to phosphorus, and the K refers to potassium. Now, because these are the main nutrients needed for growth, and people buy commercial fertilizer to promote growth, on every box of fertilizer, you'll see three numbers. For example, you might see 24-6-6. Okay, this refers to the fact that that fertilizer contains, by weight, 24% nitrogen, 6% phosphorus, and 6% potassium. An 18-51-20 fertilizer contains, by weight, 18% nitrogen, 22% phosphorus, and 16% potassium. Now, they may not spell it out for you that way, but all you need to know is that that's how it's written on the box. The numbers, those three numbers, are in that order, NPK. That's all you need to know. They're always in that order. And then you'd know, okay, well, 24-6-6 is high in nitrogen. That might even be called a nitrogen fertilizer. If you see 24-6-6, you know right away that it's really high in nitrogen. Does that make sense? So do you see the point I'm making here? When we talk about the nutrients we need, we're talking about plants. And when we're talking about the nutrients plants need, we're talking about minerals, nutrients in the soil, these mineral nutrients. These are the underlying needs of plants and humans, and they're plant-based. Or rather, they're not animal-based. So let's talk a bit about the three main nutrients and what they're used for so that you can identify problems in your own garden. So you've got nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. They each play a role, and there's a time you may need to add a jolt of one or the other depending on any kind of deficiency. So here's how it breaks down. Nitrogen promotes leaf and stem growth. So if you use an excess of nitrogen, you may cause a lot of foliage growth, but you might be doing so at the expense of flowers and fruit. So unless there's a real nitrogen deficiency, or unless you're fertilizing a tree that doesn't have flowers or fruit that you're trying to produce, then just be careful not to overload fruit and flower bearing plants with nitrogen. Too much nitrogen produces dark green foliage, little or no flowers or fruits, because again, it's really focusing on the foliage, and burnt leaf tips. If there's too little nitrogen, you'd see light green or yellow leaves. You'd see slow growth, especially in the lower leaves of the older plants. You'd see a lot of yellowing. So what about nitrogen fertilizers? If you need to go get a nitrogen fertilizer, you can get cottonseed meal, alfalfa meal, flaxseed meal, and soybean meal. These are fantastic nitrogen fertilizers. Phosphorus is very important for root growth. Flowering bulbs and root crops can always use some phosphorus, so you might want to add phosphorus, for instance, if you're planting bulbs in the fall. It's also crucial for producing flowers, and you'll sometimes see fertilizers with a high phosphorus content advertised as flower boosters. Now, an excess of phosphorus is rare, but when it does occur, symptoms are similar to an excess of nitrogen. Phosphorus deficiency, however, is revealed by deep green or red or purple leaves, very few blooms, very few fruits, and then also yellowing bottom leaves and stunted growth. Typically, bone meal is recommended for phosphorus, but that's not necessary. Rock phosphate is what you'd look for. It's better. It's not from slaughtered animals. Potassium promotes disease resistance, and it's needed for overall plant health. It keeps the plants growing, and it aids their immune system. Potassium toxicity will create nitrogen, phosphorus, and trace mineral imbalances. So you're always trying to kind of reach a balance when you're fertilizing your plants. Potassium deficiency produces very tall plants with weak stems and the leaf tips turning yellow and then later brown. Great sources of potassium include kelp meal, seaweed, and wood ashes. So that's what we're talking about in a nutshell. Those are the primary nutrients, and there are sources online if you want to look at like potential nutrient deficiencies for things like calcium and boron and iron, etc. Now, all of these things can be purchased on their own. Many garden stores have things such as kelp meal and rock phosphate. Just go to a large nursery or a good nursery and ask them to carry something if they don't have it already. One brand in particular is a favorite of ours, and it's called Down to Earth. Their website is downtoearthdistributors.com. Now, you can't buy from them directly on the website, but you'll see at least what their product line looks like, and they make really good stuff. All of their boxes are from 100% recycled paper, and those boxes are unbleached, and according to their website, you could even shred the boxes and put them in your compost bin. They sell alfalfa meal and cottonseed meal and kelp meal, rock phosphate, soybean meal, pretty much everything I just named above. In addition to selling single nutrient fertilizers, those that I just named, they also have fertilizer mixes or fertilizer blends. But like most blends, they contain animal products, basically slaughterhouse waste. You'll see such things on many labels: blood meal, bone meal, hoof meal, horn meal, feather meal, fish emulsion, fish heads, you name it, etc. So you got blood meal, bone meal, manure, dried blood, ground up bones, waste from slaughterhouse animals. Now, the animal fertilizer industry is big business. And just as with the leather industry, they make it seem like they're doing us a favor by letting us, the consumer, use the gallons and gallons of blood that comes out of billions and billions of animals every year. I wouldn't use animal-based fertilizer any more than I would buy leather or meat. It's all the same. It's all from the same industry. In terms of public safety, there is debate about the risk of BSE, bovine spongiform encephalopathy, or mad cow disease from fertilizing with blood meal or bone meal, though many experts will say there's very little risk. The prion protein that's thought to cause bovine spongiform encephalopathy or BSE has not been found in blood or bone or muscle, only in the brain, spinal cord, and the small intestine of cattle. So as far as contracting BSE from eating plants that were grown with this stuff, I'm not an expert, but I venture to guess that the real risk would be with the person spreading this stuff, you know, the person actually distributing this stuff on the crops. The risk is them inhaling the particles, which is why they recommend wearing a mask. Yeah, I mean, so like, you know, so I hopefully those people are wearing masks. Now, I think our risk of getting BSE from just eating the plants is pretty low. I think the larger issue is the ethical consideration of supporting, indirectly supporting, the slaughter system, right? I mean, even though I'm not going to buy the stuff in my own garden, what does that mean for those of us who are buying our produce from suppliers who may use it on the food they grow for us to eat, right? It's kind of a larger issue. We're doing our best to avoid supporting the animal slaughter industry, only to realize that the plants we're buying were fertilized with the blood and the bones of animals. So it's a bigger issue. I don't have the answer. I think maybe growing as much of our own food as possible is certainly one answer. Starting a community garden with like-minded folks so you can have access to a greater yield of produce. Talking to your local farmers about what they fertilize with, and certainly supporting those farmers so that you really know exactly what your food is grown with. These are all suggestions, but it's certainly not a perfect world, and I don't have all the answers. So back to Down to Earth. In addition to the animal product laden blends they have, Down to Earth also sells a vegan mix, which comes in 6-pound boxes and 25-pound bags and 50-pound bags. And it's a mix of different nutrients, such as soybean meal and rock phosphate and alfalfa meal and some other things. And we love them for that. I would just love that there's a vegan mix. That's just really awesome of them. So see if you can find it in your local garden store. Ask them to carry it. However, we still don't use any of these things only. Like, one of the most important elements of our garden is organic fertilizer, not just these single nutrients, right? So keep in mind that there's a difference between adding nutrients to plants, like the ones that I named, adding extra nitrogen because it looks like it has a nitrogen deficiency. That's one aspect of gardening. But what you really want to do is nourish the soil. You want the healthiest soil you can possibly produce. Sometimes the plants need a boost and we'll do that. But just as we cannot live on supplements alone, which is essentially what these single nutrient fertilizers are, neither can our plants. They need a strong, healthy foundation. And that can only come from strong, healthy soil, which comes from organic matter. Now, before I get into that organic matter, let me say briefly here that when you're building a garden, you'll most likely need soil, just plain soil, and often that's called topsoil. You may not have enough in your own yard for creating a garden or if you're building a raised bed. You're going to need soil. So just keep in mind that some topsoil brands add amendments. That's what these nutrients are that I named. And often they're animal-based. They think they're doing us a favor, so they'll add chicken manure to a topsoil. Oh, but it's adding extra nutrients and nitrogen. Whatever. Tell them you don't want it. So go to a garden store. Ask for topsoil with no amendments. And we find it wherever we go. And we go to just kind of, you know, a lot of basic gardening stores for this kind of thing and just ask them for it. And also consult your local dump for things like soil and mulch. I know it sounds kind of funny, but our city dump has a whole program for these things, and we've gotten a ton of soil and we've gotten a ton of mulch, especially from them at half the cost that a garden store charges. You just need a pickup truck to transport it. You go to the dump and they literally just dump this huge amount. You tell them how much you want of mulch into the back of your truck. We borrow a truck for this purpose, and then you just come home and you just shovel it onto your garden. So check out the dump. It's worth calling them about that. So now you've got your plain old soil and you need to amend it. You want to give it nutrients. You want to make it healthy. So unlike just adding the nutrients to plants, feeding the soil supports the whole ecosystem that exists there in your garden. And that healthy soil called humus will in turn feed your plants. And besides adding nutrients, this humus also improves the texture of the soil. The texture of the soil refers to the size of the soil particles. Sandy soils have very large particles, which means that the air and the water and the plant roots can move freely, and sometimes too much so. On the other end of the spectrum is clay soil, and clay particles obviously are so small that they pack together tightly and leave very little room for water or air or roots. Our soil, unfortunately, is clay soil, but most soils are somewhere in between. You may have heard of the term sandy loam. That's a term they used to indicate the kind of the best quality soil. It's kind of light, and it allows for air and water movement, but it also has some substance. It's like breadcrumbs. It's a texture of breadcrumbs, which usually occurs when there's plenty of organic matter in the soil. So where do you get this organic matter? What is organic matter? Well, organic matter is either plant-based or animal-based. If it's animal-based, it's manure, right? It's animal poop. You'll see many different names on the bags. They don't usually just say animal poop, but I find the names very funny. We say chicken manure, but we say bat guano. We say dairy manure, which is obviously manure from dairy farms, or steer manure, but we say worm castings. It's all the same. It's all poop. Sounds innocent enough, but all that poop is from the animal exploitation industry, and I, for one, don't want to support that. So you'll typically see chicken manure in your fertilizers, but you'll also see things like bat guano. It's also called seabird guano, which is just bat poop and bird poop. Now, we've never bought this stuff on principle, bat guano, for instance, but I've talked with a friend of mine about this. She's also vegan and she's a gardener, and we've talked about, well, okay, what harm is there in harvesting bat poop, right? The figure, you're like, go into the bat cave, you get some poop and you leave. But it's actually a lot more complicated than that. It turns out to be this huge political issue that also has ethical considerations. Wars have been fought over the harvesting of guano. Guano is harvested on various islands, particularly off of Peru. And because these islands are uninhabitable by people, humans, they have been home to mass seabird colonies for many, many centuries. In the 19th century, Peru is famous for its supply of guano. And there's now a big controversy over returning there again today to basically harvest the last of the guano. And I'll post a really fascinating New York Times article about the history and the current struggle on the message board. There are other things to consider as well. So guano refers not only to the seabird droppings outside of Peru, but also to bat droppings. It's basically, you know, excrement of bats that collect on the floor of caves. So back to my conversation with my friend about the seeming harmlessness of harvesting the stuff from caves. Well, first of all, there's the fact that guano deposits actually support a number of cave-adapted invertebrate species, which rely on bat feces as their sole nutrients. So the larger ecosystem is at risk when you just haul the stuff away. You know, it turns out that everything's connected. You know, everything's intricately connected. You know, these things don't exist in a vacuum. And some species just really freak out, like they'll starve to death if they're disturbed. They kind of go into a panic. They might drop their pups when they're in this panic. And so obviously it leads to a reduction in population. Research in Jamaica has shown that mining for bat guano is directly related to the loss of bat species and associated invertebrates. And it's the greatest threat to bat caves on the island. So that's bat guano, and that's not an option for us. There's also worm castings, which you may have heard of. And on principle, we don't get worm castings, though I do think there is substantially reduced harm when compared to slaughterhouse waste, like chicken manure and bat guano even. To harvest worm poop, you basically have worm compost bins with worms happily living in their own dirt-filled environment. So they're kind of in their own natural environment. They get their favorite foods. They're kept in a, you know, a climate that's perfect for them. But, you know, I don't know. I don't trust it on a commercial level, just because when you start mass producing things, I don't know. Until I know more about the breeding of these worms and the harvesting process, I think I'll just stick with other organic matter. So I guess I'm kind of iffy on the worm casting thing. If you want to use worm castings, I think you can kind of decide for yourself. Now, we had a worm compost bin at one point, but we just felt so bad when we didn't do it right. If there was too much moisture or too little moisture, and we just felt really obligated to those little lives. So we stopped worm composting. It just didn't work for us. It didn't make us comfortable. But I'll say more about worms a little later on. So now that we've eliminated organic matter from animals, essentially, what are we left with? Organic matter from plants, of course, and you create this by composting. Compost is the single best thing for your garden. It's the best. It's the cheapest. It's the richest. It creates the richest soil. It's the best. It's better than any of those things you can get in a box. All of those things I named, they're great, again, for supplements, but that's not what you want to rely on when you're gardening. You can compost garden waste and yard waste if you have room in your yard for a large pile of such things. You just combine it with some soil. You aerate it every so often so the waste breaks down and then eventually creates this really nutrient-rich soil. But the other option, which is a great one, is to compost all those fruit and veggie scraps that we vegans have a lot of, or we should have a lot of, assuming you're eating your fruits and veggies. We are composting maniacs because we generate a huge amount of fruit and veggie scraps, and it was definitely a trial and error process. Many cities provide compost bins at low cost, but you can find them virtually anywhere. Contact your city or your county to see what they provide. I can tell you, though, after many years of composting and many different kinds of compost bins, we've settled on the round type, not the big square kind that you have to dig a shovel into every few days or so to aerate. That's certainly an option. And by the way, I say aerate. Aerating basically means that you get oxygen in to help create your compost. And that's why we like the round ones so much. There are a few different kinds, but ours is basically like large drums on their side that sit on a runner, and we spin it, you know, every so often to get the oxygen flowing. It's just really easy, and they work really well. They produce compost the fastest, and we still have our square one. We have three compost bins, but we generate compost from the round ones much faster. What's more is that these compost bins also create compost tea, which is basically liquid compost, and it's super, super concentrated. So it's really, really good for your plants. When you compost correctly, when you get it down, your compost doesn't smell at all. It's just absolutely remarkable. That's when you know you're doing it right. And the compost tea that comes out, you'd think this compost tea, this concentrated, you know, compost would smell really bad, but it's totally odorless. It's absolutely amazing. Now, for larger things that don't break down as easily, things that, like, we get young coconuts, we will get young coconut for the young coconut water, or avocado pits, or the compostable, biodegradable forks and plates and cups that I use in my cooking classes. Oakland, amazingly, once again, Oakland rocks. It has a fantastic composting service. So now our big green bin, which used to be only for yard scraps that they would compost, the city would compost, now it takes all sorts of compostable kitchen scraps. So we'll send the larger things to that bin, which is awesome because we're producing less waste this way. Oakland has a goal. I can't remember what the percentage is, but they're trying to reduce waste by a substantial amount, by a huge percentage. And one of the ways they're doing that is through this aggressive compost program. But for our regular scraps, we want to benefit from the compost because we want to use it in our own garden. So for the most part, we use our own bins. to compost, and I encourage you to do the same thing. There is so much on the internet out there about composting. It's a simple process, though it takes a little time to kind of, you know, get the knack so that you know what kind of balance you're trying to strike. And don't give me any excuses that you're like in a small place, you don't have the room. We had a compost bin in our back stairwell when we rented in an apartment building. So it's possible from anywhere. And then we used the compost that I generated for, you know, house plants. You can give it to friends or save it for when you have your own little plot of land that you'll garden in. So technically we do worm composting because one of the signs of a healthy compost bin is that it's full of worms. And we have a ton of worms in our bins. They fertilize the soil by eating our veggie scraps, and we thank them for our nutrient-rich soil that helps produce our garden. Now, that's a cycle I can live with. That's very different than those who say that we have to breed cattle or we have to breed chickens so that we can have their poop. The worms give us their poop, and they just came along. We didn't do anything. They just showed up when they saw that there was a party going on in our compost bin, and then they poop. So that's very different, and we accept that. Other organic fertilizers include peat moss. Some people use peat moss, which works well to kind of loosen the soil and give it nutrients. And also cover crops is another way to increase the nutrients in your soil. Cover crops like clover or fava beans are basically planted to add nitrogen to the soil of the whole garden. And we do this periodically in one of our raised beds. The problem is you wind up having these awesome plants like fava beans that you want to harvest because you want to eat them, but you have to make the decision whether you're going to eat the crop or you're going to keep it in the ground to add nutrients. So you basically till the plants back into the soil, leaving the roots in and letting them decompose in the garden. And it's another way of adding nutrients into the soil. No need for animal products. Okay. Now, before I close, I want to talk about other aspects of a vegan gardening. For me, being vegan touches every aspect of my life and my husband's as well. We just try to live in such a way that causes as little harm as possible to any other being, human or non-human. And in doing so, you're faced with various dilemmas about how to do that, you know, in our modern world, because life isn't perfect, this world isn't perfect. So you try and you make mistakes and you learn and you try again and you just do the best you can. Our front and backyards, by no means big, we live in the San Francisco Bay Area after all, are definitely a haven for us and other critters. It's something that we are intentionally creating. We're trying to create a backyard wildlife sanctuary and just a sanctuary for all of us. We pulled up our front lawn, we planted several gardens, and we're still working on them all the time. We have planted over 19 trees on our property. And again, our property is not that big, but because they're all babies now, I think we're actually underestimating how big they're going to get. I think we're going to be taken over by these trees. Some of them are dwarf trees, but still, we planted a lot of trees and we'll get to benefit from them, I guess, about 20 years from now. We have a garden just for flowers that attract bees and butterflies and hummingbirds. I'm visited by hummingbirds every single day who come like within, I'm not kidding, they'll come within 3 inches of my face and just kind of fly like, hey, what's up? What are you doing? We keep trays of water all around the yard for the wildlife, and every morning and every evening the birds are out there bathing and drinking. We put food out for the birds. Certainly at one point we struggled, as everyone does, with the squirrels eating the bird food. We tried getting a baffle to stop them. We tried different bird feeders, but those little acrobats just kept hopping on the thing and throwing the bird seed all over the place. I mean, I wasn't demonizing them. People just demonize squirrels. It's just amazing. But, you know, I was like frustrated because I was trying to feed the birds and the squirrels kept knocking over the thing. And then one day it hit me that the squirrels just want to eat. They just want to eat food. And so we put a squirrel feeder out and we filled it with peanuts. And wouldn't you know, we created harmony in the yard. I stopped being frustrated. I now put birdseed in the feeder, but also on the ground because that's where it winds up anyway, because the squirrels still do go for the bird feeder. But now, when you look out there, you've got birds on the ground and squirrels on the ground and some birds in the feeder. And then you've got the we don't have blue jays. We have scrub jays who are just so funny and smart and sassy and bold, just like the squirrels. And they want the peanuts too. As soon as they hear me come outside, they fly right up to me and they wait for their peanuts. Now, they don't sit on my lap, but the squirrels, do. The squirrels will sit right on my lap and eat the peanuts. So there's this harmony. It's just amazing. It's just so lovely. And we recently cat-proofed our yard. So Simon and Schuster now go outside in the backyard, which is fantastic. They just love it. And it just makes us feel really good. They're totally safe. They can't get out. Other cats don't come in. Although there were some skunks in the backyard a couple weeks ago, but they're so damn cute and they were fine. They just kind of walked away. And I don't leave the cats outside when I'm not home. They just love to just hang out there and find their favorite spot. And I was very cautious in the beginning about how that was going to work. You know, like birds and squirrels and cats don't usually make a great combination. But in the spirit of harmony we've created, the cats could care less. Seriously, the birds are all over the yard when the cats are outside. They don't fly away unless the cats were like, you know, kind of walking right over to them. And especially in the evening is my favorite time when the activity is the highest. The cats are kind of excited because it's cooling down and the birds are all coming down from the trees and they're getting the water. And even when the cats are outside, they don't care. It's like the cats know not to bother them. The birds know they're not going to bother them. The squirrels, they could care less. They'll run right over to the cats and taunt them. And Simon and Schuster just ignore them. I'm not stupid. I know they're cats, and cats are cats. So like if one of the squirrels runs back and forth really quickly in front of Simon and Schuster, you know, they definitely display interest, but they know not to chase them. And I'm not making this up. They just don't go after them. I have fed the squirrels on my lap with Simon and Schuster sitting on either side of my lap with the squirrel right there. Right there. And there's just harmony. It's just amazing. It's just peace and harmony. So having said that, I won't pretend that we don't deal with the challenges of certain little buggers who want to eat our crops. You know, we want to create harmony. We don't want to kill anything in our yard. But there are challenges when you're growing things. Of the 19 trees we planted, 9 of them are fruit trees. We planted a pluot, an Asian pear, an apple, a pomegranate, a Meyer lemon, a persimmon, a fig, almond, and a mulberry. And in fact, in a few years, if things go well, I imagine we'll be fruitarians from all the fruit we're going to get from these trees. We also have raised beds and, you know, plant everything depending on the season, chard, lettuce, peas, tomatoes, etc. And we are faced, like all gardeners are, with insects who want to eat our goods. Truth be told, the best defense against these things is healthy soil. It's really true. The healthier the plant, the more adept they are at dealing with attackers. We've been very lucky to have had no real problems so far, but we've definitely had things like snails. And I know you won't be surprised to hear this from me. I think snails are cute. I just think they're cute. Even if they weren't cute, I'm like not trying to destroy anybody. So I didn't want to, you know, kill the snails. And I remember several years ago when we first started asking people for non-lethal ways to deal with snails, people would get really excited because like they had an answer and they'd be like, so you put beer in a cup and you leave it in the garden and the snails love the taste. So they crawl in. And I'd be like, crawl in what? And they'd be like, oh, they drown. And I'd be like, no, I don't want to kill them. And they'd say, oh, no, they love it. You just put the beer out and they love the beer. And I'd say, no, I don't want to kill them. And they'd go, I don't know. Every single person would have the same reaction. I don't want to kill them. Oh, no, they like it. No, I don't want to kill them. Oh, like it didn't register. Like they just thought they were killing them with kindness, you know, because they were using beer. I don't know. So we stopped asking people and we just devised our own methods. And they work. We escort them to other parts of the yard. I know it seems laborious, but you know, harmony and all that. So we'd go outside usually in the evening when they'd all come out of God knows where and descend upon the garden, and we would pick them up and carry them over to other parts of the yard where they could eat to their little snails' hearts are content. That's number one. Number two is we tried to stop them from getting to those plants in the first place. And the best way to do that is by using copper. Snails detest copper because it kind of shocks them as they slime over the copper. It gives them a little electric shock. So some garden stores, and if you can't find them in stores, get them online, sell copper tape and copper mesh. And we use the mesh as little fences around some of our gardens. Around the raised bed, we literally adhere strips of copper to the entire periphery of the raised bed, which stops them from getting up there in the first place. And it's always worked. It works better in one garden over the other just because of the nature of the structure of the garden, but it works. Copper works. The other thing you can do is just give up a couple plants to the snails. Just create a little garden in one corner of the yard or plot away from the main garden, and they can munch, you know, as much as they want. We do this with our berries. Our intention is to have a garden that will sustain us someday, but we also want to feed wildlife. We're creating this wildlife sanctuary. So we give up some of our berries on the mulberry tree, for instance, to the birds. Unfortunately, we haven't had an almond yet or a fig because the squirrels get there before we do, which is really annoying because they'll like take a bite out of a fig and then leave the rest. You know, I'm like, if you're going to take it, take the whole thing or leave us the whole thing. We also cannot have sunflowers growing in our garden because the squirrels shimmy up the sunflower and rip the heads off and then carry the head away and just dine on the seeds inside the flower. It's quite amazing. We didn't realize it at first why our sunflowers were beheaded until we busted them one day shimmying up, you know, complete vertical, shimmying up the sunflower and beheading the sunflower. So we'll eventually put netting over the trees, the almond trees, to stop those guys. But, you know, we're just going to give some up. We just kind of accept that. Also, depending on the type of plant, even if there's some damage to some leaves, it doesn't mean that they'll destroy the whole plant or the whole crop. So we remove any buggers we see, but the whole idea of spraying an entire garden to destroy all insects, the harmful as well as the beneficial, is ridiculous. We sustain some damage as long as the plant itself can still grow and thrive. But look, we're not perfect. On our chard, for instance, leaf miners would destroy the crop if we didn't stop them when they're in the egg stage. So we just check the underside of the leaves and we pick them off. We use jet spray on the hose to rinse off any insects like aphids on certain trees that they're attracted to. You know, that kind of thing. You know, we do want to live harmoniously, but we really do the best we can. And I know naysayers like to catch vegans at being imperfect. And they'll say like, but those holier-than-thou vegans, they're responsible for killing insects. Don't they care about insects? The bottom line is I don't pledge to be perfect and I don't pledge to be holier-than-thou. I do the best I can. And there's great joy and humility in doing so. I realize that some insects will die at my expense and I'm sorry for that. But the fact is many, many animals will not die at my expense. And that's why I do what I do. So I encourage you to get out there and start your own garden, even if it's just a tiny little plot or some plants in pots where you can grow some herbs. There's so many things we can do to start growing our own food. And as you do so, I wish you much health and harmony as you create a sanctuary for yourself and for all of those who visit, for the animals, both human and non-human. This is Colleen with Compassionate Cooks. Thanks for listening.